right, welcome back. Hey, just so you know, as we move through, it's the other one, the intelligent design one first. We're going to do that next. I've got some free books to give away at the end of this session and at the end of the following session. To those who listen and take good notes, I'm going to reward you with actually a few study Bibles, believe it or not, and some More Than a Carpenter's. So here's what we're going to do. Because of some of the questions in the nature of the dialogue, we're going to spend this first session talking about intelligent design and some of the science, because that came up so much. And then we're going to take a break, have a handful of worship songs, and then we're going to look at the evidence for the New Testament, and then we'll take some questions then as well. So after this session, I'm going to stop and see what questions that you have. So while I'm talking, here's what I want you to do. I want you to listen critically. Number one, make sure you understand. If you don't, make a little check and say, ask about that. Number two, be thinking, boy, what would a critic say to this? How would somebody challenge it? And think of tough questions to ask, because that's how you grow and that's how this stuff really sinks in. And if there's any questions left over from the beginning that I threw out and didn't answer, that would be a time to kind of make sure we process those as well. All right? Not too long ago, I live in Southern California, a little place called San Juan Capistrano. And not too long ago, one of the new versions of the iPhone came out. So I decided to get in line. It came out on Friday. Saturday, I got in line. I was in line about 4 hours waiting for my phone. The line went out of the Apple store and down like four or five stores, and I'm sitting there just moving a few feet every, 30 minutes. And these three high school students come walking up to the guy right next to me. And they said, hey, we're talking about Jesus. What do you think? Well, the guy doesn't say a single word. Turns around, leans on the railing, completely ignores them. So they're a little embarrassed, collect themselves, and they start to walk away. I said, hey, what are you guys doing? They said, well, we're talking about Jesus. What do you think? I said, I'm not even sure he existed. Do you actually believe that Christian stuff? The guy says, well, of course I do. Jesus died on the cross for your sins, and if you want to go to heaven and have eternal life, you have to believe in him. I said, well, that's an interesting story. Why should I believe that that's true? He picks up his Bible. He says, well, this book is the word of God, and the Bible says it. And of course, I said, well, how do I know that that book is the word of God? How do I know that book's true? He says, well, if you turn to 2 Timothy 3:16, it says that all scripture is inspired. Is that a good argument? If you want to know if the Bible is true, can you use the Bible to prove itself? No. Right? But then I pointed out to him, and he goes, I said, do you have any evidence that actually tells us that book is true without assuming the book is true? He said, yes, don't you know there's these tens of thousands of ancient manuscripts that completely match up and tell us that we have the Bible just as it was written down? I said, really? Do you know how many words are in the original Greek New Testament? And at this point, I know exactly what he was thinking. Why did I have to talk to this guy? He said, no, I said about 136,000 words. Then I pointed out that if you take the original Greek manuscripts he's talking about and you compare them with each other, the ancient manuscripts, there's between 300,000 and 400,000 differences. So I said, that means for every word in the Bible, you could have two or three other words. A minute ago, you said that we have the Bible exactly as it was written. Now we realize it doesn't. Can you explain that to me? He goes, what do you think about evolution? I said, I'm glad you asked. The evidence is overwhelming. Don't you know we share 99.5% DNA with chimps? Don't you know we have vestigial structures in our back left over from our ancestors who had tails? Don't you know in embryological development, I'm going on and on, and he's just backing up and his eyes are getting bigger and bigger. Finally, I stopped. I said, I got a confession to make. I'm a Christian. And I wish you could have been there, because he goes, oh. But a girl standing right next to him looked bothered by this. She said, was all that true? I said, well, some yes, a lot of it no. And I said, look, I'm a Christian. I believe the Bible's true. I said, I'm a Christian. I don't believe in Darwinian evolution. I believe God created the world, just like you do. But here's the difference between me and you. I know why I believe it's actually true. I have good reasons to back it up. you just have blind faith. Well, we had an interesting conversation after we talked for a while. They left and went on their way. 10 minutes later, I'm facing this direction. I feel a tap on the shoulder. I turn around and it's three new students who say, "We're talking about Jesus, what do you think?" Well, I start launching into my charade until I look over their shoulders, about as far back as the back of this room. I see the original students who set up their friends to convert the atheist. Yeah, go talk to that guy. Now, my guess is that you admire these students on a Saturday in summer in Southern California, when they could be at the beach, they're at the mall sharing their faith with strangers. But what do you think is going to happen to these students if they didn't take the time to start understanding why they believe what they believe and get to the university? And they have a professor who did the role playing I did, but doesn't take off his jacket and say, "Ah, I'm actually a Christian now, let's try to make sense of this." Probably the same thing that happened to a Harvard biologist by the name of E.O. Wilson. He said, quote, "When I was 15, I entered the Southern Baptist Church with great fervor and interest in the fundamentalist religion. I left at 17 when I got to the University of Alabama and heard about evolutionary theory." Now, you might be thinking, sometimes people push back and say, "What's the big deal about evolution? Why not just say God exists, evolution is true, and maybe God used evolution? Why are Christians always fighting science?" is how people make it sound. But here's the important thing to keep in mind. Evolution is not just a scientific theory. Do you realize this? It's not like gravity or plate tectonics. Evolution has become an ideology. It's become the basis of an entire worldview in conflict with Christianity. Now, what do I mean by that? Dinesh D'Souza, who used to work at the Reagan White House, said, quote, "We have Darwinism, but not Keplerism. We encounter Darwinists, but no one describes himself as an Einsteinian. Darwinism has become an ideology." Now, I tell this to my students all the time when I teach, and sometimes they believe me, sometimes they don't. Well, I had a girl email me back. She graduated high school from my Christian school, went to a public school, a state school in California. And she wrote me an email that looks exactly like this. It says, go ahead and throw it out there. It says, "I have been inundated with evolutionary theory. Oh my gosh, it's caps everywhere. Exclamation point, smiley face. My psychology class, my biology class." She went on and on about how in all of her different classes, she was getting hammered, so to speak, with evolutionary theory. Now, it makes sense that you would learn evolutionary theory in biology class. But why sociology? Why psychology? Why history? Because evolution is the basis of an entire worldview or way of thinking and understanding the world apart from God. So if evolution is true, and by evolution I mean Darwinian evolution, then everything in the world, all our beliefs, all our behavior, has to have some kind of evolutionary explanation. So I read an article in the New York Times a couple years ago, and here was the title. You could probably Google it and find it. It was "Why We Like Hot Chilies, an Evolutionary Explanation." I saw another article. It said, "Why Men Prefer Blondes Over Brunettes." I'm not saying if this is true or false. I'm just saying what the article said. It said, "Why Men Prefer Blondes Over Brunettes, an Evolutionary Explanation." And they said, "On the plains, when we were hunters and gatherers, there were more brunettes and blondes were commodities, so they competed." I mean, they went on and on. I'm reading, this is just gobbledygook. But if evolution is true, they have to give an evolutionary explanation for everything. Right? Are you following with me? So there's a guy by the name of Daniel Dennett, a.k.a. Santa Claus. Okay, that's what I call him. He's an outspoken atheist. Very well-known, articulate, thoughtful atheist. He wrote a book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And although I disagree with almost everything in the book, I thought he made a point that was very, very profound. He said, "Darwinism is a universal acid." Now, what do you mean by that? How many of you have seen at least one of the Alien or Aliens or the recent Prometheus film? Okay, what's the blood of the aliens? It's acid. What does acid do? It burns and it dissolves everything in its path. So acid would eat away, you know, the tile out there or the concrete or the cement or wood or metal. It dissolves everything in its path. He said Darwin's theory is like this, that if we have evolved according to the Darwinian process, then all of our traditional beliefs need to be dissolved and re-understood through a Darwinian lens. So this is why we get books like this. Why We Get Sick, The New Science of Darwinian Medicine. Or books like this, Economics as an Evolutionary Science. Or books like Evolutionary Jurisprudence, How to Understand the Legal System from an Evolutionary Perspective. Or Religion Explained, The Evolutionary Origins of Religious Thought. Or Literary Darwinism, Evolution, Human Nature, and Literature. But it's not just in academia when you get to the university. It's actually found, it finds its way into popular culture on a regular basis. So do any of you still watch like the reruns on TV of the TV show Friends? Any of you still watch this? Okay, I suspected quite a few of you did. Well, if there was a character on Friends who doubted evolution, who would it be? Phoebe. Why? Why would she be the character that would doubt evolution? Because she's the dumb blonde, right? I'm not saying blondes are dumb. My daughter's blonde. I speak to her very slowly. I'm just kidding. Oh, man, cheap shot. I know, blonde or Raider fan, I'd take the blonde any day. So in this one TV episode of Friends, Ross discovers that Phoebe doubts evolution. And here's what Ross says. He says, excuse me, evolution is not for you to buy, Phoebe. Evolution is scientific fact. Like the air we breathe, like gravity. That's the message. The evolution is obviously true. It's a scientific fact, and you're an idiot if you doubt it. But see, here's the question. And this is one of the most important questions for you to really understand and answer in your life right now. Are you ready? It's this. Are we accidental byproducts of blind forces in nature? Or are we the pinnacle of creation intended by a personal and a loving God? In other words, are you a cosmic accident because of the laws of physics and chance? Or have you been fastened since the time of the womb by a God who loves you, knows the number of hairs in your head, and has a plan for your life? It's hard to think of a more important question than that. Are we a cosmic accident as a species doomed to annihilation, or have we put here purposefully by God for a reason? Now, every single worldview in philosophy has to answer this question. So every worldview looks like this. So number one is the origin story, which is a question of how did we get here? Every single religion, every single philosophy of life has to answer the question, how is it that humans got here? Second, what went wrong? Why are things broken? And third, how do we fix it? The resolution. Every worldview looks at it that way. By the way, every movie does. Act one is the origin of how we get here and the characters. Act two, something goes wrong. Act three, here, we fixed it. Every commercial, introduction. It's a character. Oh, it's great. Something went wrong. The teenager has his it. Resolution. Here's how we fix it with OxyClear. Whatever it is. I just made that up. Every story has this and every worldview has it. Okay. So for example, let me give you an example. What's taught in the largest church in America, and large church in America, I mean the Church of Oprah. She teaches something called New Age, which says the origin story is we were eternally a part of the God consciousness of the universe. That's the origin. The predicament is we forgot that we were God. So what's the resolution? If the problem is forgetting, what's the solution? Remember. So she talks about remembering the divine spark that's within. Okay? Now, throw the next slide up there for me. The Christian story is very straightforward. The origin is in the beginning, God created, right? Genesis 1:1. What's the problem? sin. We said to our Creator, nope, we'll do it our way, forget you. And we sinned and fell short of the glory of God. And everybody in unison, what's the solution? Jesus. Oh man, I was hoping for better than that. The resolution for God's love of the world in one word is?
Jesus.
Nice job. So God created us, we rebelled, Jesus saves us. That's the Christian story. Does everybody understand? Well, the Darwinian story is very different. There's a well-known atheist by the name of Victor Stenger. And for the origin, he says, throw up Darwinism up there for me. He says, throw the first one, origin. Darwinism implies that humanity developed by accident. So it's not that you've been made in the image of God. It's not that you're here for a reason. You're a cosmic accident. Okay? What's the problem with the world? The problem is not moral and sin. The problem is evolution is just kind of a clumsy process and things get hurt in the middle of it. So what's the solution? It's not Jesus, it's what? It's usually fix our own problems through the methods of science. There you go. Now, you know, Darwin understood his story and he actually followed it to its logical conclusion. You know what Darwin himself said? Throw up this next quote by Darwin. He said, the view now held by most physicists is that the sun with all the planets will in time grow too cold for life. Unless indeed some great body dashes into the sun and thus gives it fresh life. Believing as I do that man in the distant future will be a far more perfect creature. Notice he says man will be a perfect creature. He's not there yet. He didn't say women will be a perfect creature. They're already there. Us men are lagging behind. Can I get an amen from the ladies? Okay. Oh, I got a lot. I'm not sensing the love anymore. All right. He says, man, it'll be a far more perfect creature than he is now. It is an intolerable thought that he and all other sentient beings are doomed to complete annihilation after such a long, continued, slow progress. Did you hear what he just said? If there is no God, there's no eternal soul. He said, we've been evolving and getting better, but it's a bummer because eventually the sun's going to run out of energy and it's all going to reach a heat death in the universe and stay that way for eternity. That's the Darwinian worldview without God. That's the Darwinian worldview. So in a second, we're going to look at the positive case, but there's something that really interests me. I wrote a book I didn't bring here called Understanding Intelligent Design. And there's something that really surprised me. Because when I started to read, I don't just read those who agree with me. I read both sides. And one thing amazed me is how many skeptics and atheists admit, everybody hear this, how many skeptics and atheists admit that the world looks like it was designed. Did you know that? Time and time again, I'd run into skeptics. They'd say, boy, the world really looks designed. We know it's not, but it really looks designed. So, for example, Richard Dawkins famously said, he said, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Isn't that odd? He's saying, boy, the natural world really looks like it was designed, but we know it's not. Now, I got a question. If something smells like a duck, swims like a duck, eats like a duck, and sounds like a duck, chances are it's what? A duck. There's one person who said a cat. There must be freshmen here again. That's okay. I love freshmen. If all the signs are that it's a duck, maybe it's a duck. If both believers and non-believers say, boy, the world really looks like it was fastened for a purpose, maybe that's because it was. Well, what we're going to see is in the past few decades, is there have been scientific breakthroughs that I get goosebumps just thinking about. Because they show that something David wrote 3,000 years ago is true. Do you know 3,000 years ago, before any scientific advancements, David said, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. So just like a painting reveals something about the artist, the natural world tells us something about the Creator. And we don't have time to go into all of them, but we're going to look at three examples. And if you'll throw it up here for me, the next slide of, this is the book I wrote. We went through five examples of intelligent design Cosmology, which is how the Big Bang points towards a Big Banger in the origin of the universe, towards a cause outside of space and time. We won't look at that. Let's start with physics, okay? I want to imagine you come and visit me in Southern California, all right? And by the way, now that we've been hanging out this weekend, I live in kind of between San Diego and LA by the coast, especially when you're in college. If you're out in Southern California, you need a warm cooked meal, you need a place to do laundry, you need a place to stay, let me know, and I'll pray for you. Because we're friends now, right? Now imagine you come visit me in Southern California, and behind me we see this cabin that's about to come up here, and it looks like an abandoned cabin. So you decide you want to go explore it in the hills out behind Capistrano. When you come walking up, you notice something really strange. You hear the sound of your favorite song in the background, Beat It by Michael Jackson. So you walk up, you open up the door, you look inside and you see shoes that are just your size, a jacket that fits you perfectly. It's the temperature you like. You look in the table, it's all the books and magazines you read. You look over there and there's a TV with a video game system and the DVDs you like to watch and play. You go over to the refrigerator, you open it up and it's all the snacks that you enjoy. You walk over, there's a bathroom, you open up and it's all the toiletries, the exact brands that you normally use. Now, what would you suspect? Besides thinking that someone was stalking you, I'll tell you what you would know for sure. You know that this couldn't be chance. It couldn't be happenstance. That somebody knew you were coming ahead of time and arranged this cabin just for you, right? Do you know what scientists have learned over just the past 2, 3, maybe 4 decades? That the universe as a whole is just like this cabin. That there's certain laws of physics and constants in nature that all have one strange thing in common. They're set exactly where they need to be to have a universe even capable of supporting complex life. So Freeman Dyson, who is not a Christian but an acclaimed scientist, said, quote, as we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked to our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must in some sense have known that we were coming. See, remember when I was an atheist, I said, give me some evidence that God exists. Well, there is an argument philosophers use called the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God. And it's that the laws of physics are exquisitely fine-tuned and just right where they need to be, which indicates there's plan and purpose in the universe. So you get in the shower in the morning, you take the hot and the cold, what do? You fine-tune them so they're just right. In fact, think of like Goldilocks. Right? Not too hot, not too cold, just right. The laws that govern our universe, they're not too hot, not too cold, they're just right where they need to be. So scientists say like the laws of physics exist on a razor's edge, and the slightest change to the left or the right, and the whole universe would become inhospitable to life. So a guy by the name of Fred Hoyle, who actually coined the term Big Bang, he said, it seems as if someone has been monkeying with physics. Now, let me give you a practical example so this sinks home. I went to a university called Biola, which is in Southern California, a fantastic Christian school. If you want to go to Christian school and get a really good education, Bible and otherwise, think about going to Biola. I absolutely loved it. And I played basketball there. And I know what you're thinking, but you're short and you're white. But that proves only one thing. There must be a God. Well, my senior year at Biola, some of my good friends lived in these dorms called Thompson, and it was on the upper part of campus, and they were on like the third floor. And the thing about Thompson is right in front of it was a large parking lot. There was a tall row of trees, and then there was a huge water gutter, and then on the other side there was a stop sign. So we got the ingenious idea that we would go to one of his windows that overlooked the parking lot and take one of those huge, like, life-size water balloon launchers. Have you seen these things? They take, like, 3 people. One person holds on this side, one person holds this side, and then someone pulls back the middle and you put a water balloon, an egg, a cat in, or something like that. And you let it go. And, okay, joke about the cat. Some of you gave me nervous looks. I would never put a cat. A hamster, but not a cat. Or a puppy. Oh, look at that. No one defends cats, but everyone's like, oh, a puppy. That's messed up. So we got the idea that we would take water balloons, nothing living, and we would launch it across the stuff. And as a car pulled at the stop sign, we'd give them a surprise welcome home at night. Well, we had tried many, many, many times to hit the windshield of incoming cars and had nothing but failure. One night we're hanging out with my buddy and we see this car coming. It was like slow motion. We're like, get the water balloon launcher. Grab, you know, we get the water balloon. One of my friends holds this side of the window. One of our friends holds this side of it. And you know, it's like these big, it's like a big rubber band. Then we pull back the middle, put a water balloon in it, and we let it fly. It goes across the parking lot. It goes above the row of trees. It clears the gutter. The car pulls up to the stop sign, stops, and bam, smacks it right on the windshield and cracked it. She has a heart attack. No, I'm just kidding. Don't worry about that. That is morbid that you laughed. You guys are sick, man. It did. It like, you know, spider crack, how that happens with a windshield. Needless to say, our water balloon launching days came to an immediate end. Now, I want you to think about something. To get our target, how many things did we have just right? If there was more water in the balloon, what would happen? It wouldn't go far enough. What if there was less? It would have gone too far. What if we pulled it back more? What if we pulled it to the side? What if we pushed it down more, the angle? What if there was wind? You see how many things had to really be calibrated for the universe to be just right. Well, do you know, since the moment our universe has began, it's been expanding in every direction. Yet the weight of the universe must be just right. If the universe had more mass, it would collapse in upon itself. If there was less mass, it would expand so quickly there wouldn't be planets, stars, and life. Well, how fine-tuned is the mass? Listen to what this one NASA scientist said. He said, quote, if the balance between gravity and the expansion rate were altered by one part in 1 million, billion, 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 there would be no galaxies, stars, planets, or life. Do you know how fine-tuned that is to understand that number? That's the equivalent of all the mass in the universe compared to one grain of sand. Just let that sink in for a second. So mathematically speaking, if the equivalent of the mass of the universe varied by a grain of sand, we would have an entire universe incapable of supporting life. And yet it's exactly at the weight that it needs to be. But you know, this is only one example. Scientists have found over 30 examples like this that are each precisely set. So some of you who actually like math, or maybe there's one of you, my wife was actually a math teacher, hottest math teacher I've ever seen. Some of you are thinking, wait a minute, what happens if we take not just one of these, but two of these? So let's say we take two, what's called gravity. I think my voice just cracked. That's embarrassing. Let's say we take two. Gravity, go ahead and throw the next one up there. Force of gravity and cosmological constant, which are constants in nature, which must each be exquisitely fine-tuned. What are the mathematical odds that of all the possible ranges that these forces could have, that they would both be set right where they need to be set so our universe could be capable of supporting life? You know what the odds are? One part in 100 million, trillion, 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 trillion. Now that's a big number. If you can't grasp that number, just think of our new national debt. You know what that's equivalent to, that number? That's equivalent to one atom out of the entire universe. Friends, this is two of 30 physical parameters that must be set for life. What happens if you take all of them? Do you know what the odds are? Oxford scientist Roger Penrose said, if we combined all the laws that must be fine-tuned, We couldn't even write down that number in full, since it would require more zeros than the number of elementary particles in the universe. I don't have enough faith to believe that that happened by chance. This is a powerful piece of evidence that tells me there is a mind behind the universe. The fine tuning of the universe points towards a fine tuner. Let's look at a second example in the world of biology. Okay? And then we'll look at two examples, then we'll take some questions and feedback and work through this. In biochemistry, thank you, I'm sorry. Darwin famously said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Remember, we just talked about a way to disprove Christianity. What would it be? Find the body of Jesus. This is called a criterion of falsification. If you have the body of Jesus, Christianity is objectively false. If we could find some organ which couldn't have been developed in a step-by-step manner, evolution, in Darwin's own terms, would be false. Now, how would it disprove it? Is everyone, who in here has taken some biology class at some point in your life? Let me see your hands. And okay, good. Almost all of you have. Do you remember Darwin's tree of life? Have you seen this? How at the bottom there's a common ancestor and then life like branches out. Who's kind of seen this image before so I know? Okay, most of you. Now, all these things at the top are the result of this step-by-step, incremental, long process that got them there. So Darwin said, if you found any complex system up here in nature, but it couldn't be built in a step-by-step manner, that would prove his theory false because his theory relies upon small incremental mutations that help favor species to survive, okay? Now, in 1996, Michael Behe wrote a book, you'll throw up the next slide there for me, called Darwin's Black Box. This book has sold over 250,000 copies. For an academic book to sell 250,000 copies is crazy because he lit a fire under this debate. Now, why did he call his book Darwin's Black Box? Here's what he means. A black box is something that's very interesting, but we have no idea how it works. It's interesting, but we don't have a clue. It's a black box. So my iPhone is a black box to me. I know how to send emails and texts, and I know how to use it, but I don't have a clue how it works. It's a black box, okay? Actually, the ultimate black box to me is women. They're interesting, and my wife and daughter fascinate me. I don't have a clue what actually makes them work, okay? Now, the reason he called it Darwin's black box is because during the day of Darwin, through the technology that all scientists had, when they looked at the cell, they assumed it was very simple. They thought it was like a glob of jello that must have a very simple explanation. But as science has progressed since then, and now we can peer into the cell, we see more sophistication in the cell than anything humans can create today. It dwarfs it. So the reason he called his book Darwin's Black Box is because he said this was something Darwin was unaware of that would actually prove his ideas false. So Michael Behe gave this definition called irreducibly complex. And it's actually somewhat of a simple definition if you just think about it. He said it's a system that requires several closely matched parts in order to function, and where removal of one of the components effectively causes the system to cease function. Okay, here's the point. This is a system that has multiple parts, but if one part is gone, how well does the system work? It doesn't work at all, okay? Or it don't work is what an Oakland Raiders fan would say. Okay, I'm kidding. I'll stop, maybe. Now, the example that he gave was this. Throw up the picture of the mousetrap here for me. A mousetrap is irreducibly complex. Why? By the way, why do we need a mousetrap? Because we launched all the mice, all the cats, right? Just bringing it full circle for you. I'm just playing. Now, the mousetrap is irreducibly complex. There's multiple parts. There's a spring. There's the catch. There's the bar and the hold. And there's the wooden base. If one of those parts is missing, how well does the mousetrap work? It doesn't work at all. So either you have all the mousetrap or you have none. Right? Now, why would this be a problem for Darwin's theory? Because Darwin's theory says you couldn't have a mousetrap just show up and pop into existence because it's much too complex. But you also couldn't have it built step by step because any simpler system that's missing a part what function would it have? It would have no function. So you see why a mousetrap is a problem for Darwin's theory? Now, obviously, mousetraps are man-made. The question is there anything like a mousetrap in nature? Do you see the question? Well, in his book, Darwin's Black Box, Behe gives a whole bunch of examples. One of my favorite, throw it up here for me, is called the bacterial flagellum. You know what this thing is? This is a tail on the back of certain bacteria. It spins and it propels it through water up to 100,000 RPMs. The Honda S2000, their popular sports car, has 9,000 RPMs. That means this thing can actually go 100,000 RPMs this direction and within a quarter of a turn stop and go full speed the other direction. That's why Howard Berg from Harvard University said, quote, look on the bottom here. He said, this is the most efficient motor in the universe. This is more efficient than the space shuttle motor, than any motor we can create. And it's 1/100,000th of an inch. You know what's interesting about the flagellum? Is there's at least 40 proteins that all must be present in the right order at the right time, or what happens to the whole flagellum? It doesn't work. You see the problem? It couldn't just poof show up at once because it's too complex. But it also couldn't be built in a step-by-step manner because any simpler system missing one of those proteins or its equivalent would not function. Now, if you read most Darwinists about this, they'll say, oh, we've explained it in Michael Behe, he's an idiot. But when you actually read the data, and I've read both sides, there is no detailed explanation for how you could get something like a flagellum on the micro level without an intelligent agent guiding the way. So what have we seen? The fine-tuning of the universe points towards a fine-tuner. The engineering, even in the smallest level of the cell, has no natural explanation, but we know that intelligent agents can make irreducibly complex systems. Now let's look at the last one, which is my favorite. I skipped that last quote, into the world of biology. So go ahead, a couple more into biology. Now, I'm guessing most of you have taken a biology class at some point. Some of you raise your hand. Something very important to keep in mind. Biology is not just the study of physical processes. Biology is the study of information. Did you hear this? What makes living systems function? It's information in living systems. Since the discovery of DNA in 1953, we now know that the human body is composed of information. In fact, it's like your body is a memory stick. In fact, you can see, Dave Baltimore said, modern biology is science of information. He's a Nobel laureate. Throw that next picture up there for me. That's what the human body is like. It's as if information is stored in every single part of your body. The question is, how much information is in your body? You ready? Just get this. If you took, you have 100 trillion cells in your body. 100 trillion cells. If you took the DNA out of one cell and uncoiled it in length, it would be 9 feet in length. 9 feet in length. That means if you took all the DNA in your body and lined it up together, it would go from here to the sun and back 70 times. This is where you say, wow. Thank you. Did you grasp that? The DNA in your body all line up together from here to the sun and back 70 times? What does DNA do? It stores information. Do you know how much information is stored in one cell in your body? Richard Dawkins said, quote, you'll see it come up, the equivalent of, throw up there the next slide there for me, 8 billion letters, 500 million words, or 8,000 books. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, I saw a study that said one cell in your body could store the equivalent of 500,000 DVDs. Would you like to have that storage capacity in your iPhone? Do you see how much more technologically advanced the human body is than anything we can create. That's why Bill Gates said not too long ago, he said, quote, and here it is. He said, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. And yes, that's also true for Apple. So here's the question. Where does the information in the DNA come from? Do you understand the question? What can explain why there's so much information in DNA? Well, those who don't believe in intelligent design have an explanation, and it reminds me of one of my favorite comedies. Take a look at this clip with Jim Carrey. Oh, we need sound.
I want you to give me the honest answer. What do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me ending up together?
Well, Lloyd, that's difficult to say. We really don't...
Hit me with it. Just give it to me straight. I came a long way just to see you married. Just least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
Okay, we got it. We're good. Now that's an awesome clip. I love it. Now, why is that so funny? When she says 1 in 1,000,000, what does she mean? He doesn't have a chance. That's the point. One of the most common explanations for all this information in DNA we just saw is chance. Oh, it just happened by chance. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, came up with this idea called the monkeys typing Shakespeare theorem. Monkeys typing Shakespeare theorem. He said, if you have enough monkeys and you have enough time, eventually one of these monkeys will sit down and type out all the works of Shakespeare. Now, do you see what he's trying to say? He's trying to show how through a purposeless blind process, you can get ordered information. You see his reasoning? So the question is, if you had enough monkeys, enough time, would they sit down and really generate information? Well, there's a MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology scientist by the name of Seth Lloyd. And he mathematically computed how much information could arise by chance, given all the resources and the age of our entire universe. Could our universe produce the works of Shakespeare by chance? You know what he concluded? Not all the works of Shakespeare, not one work of Shakespeare, not one chapter, not one page, not one paragraph. All the resources in the universe by chance at best could produce 4 lines from one work of Shakespeare. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer. Now, in 2003, a decade ago, some scientists and a professor and students got together and decided to test the monkeys typing Shakespeare theorem. So they actually put some monkeys in a zoo with some computers to see if one of them would sit down and start typing out Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet. Well, the first monkey picked up a rock, climbed up on top, and started bashing the computer. I think there's pictures of it. The next monkey actually climbed up on top and urinated and defecated on the computer. But before you laugh, these monkeys actually produced 6 pages of written text. They produced 6 pages of written text in the weeks that they were in there. A string of A's, L's, M's, and an occasional J and a few S's. Not a single word. Now, in case you need some reading material for the summer, you can actually purchase the literary works of these monkeys. They've been put into a volume called Notes Towards the Complete Works of Shakespeare. You can actually buy it online. Now you're laughing because you know something very obvious, don't you? You know that when we see information, it can only come from a mind. It can't come by chance. In fact, if you do visit me in San Juan Capistrano, we go walking on the beach, and you see this that says, John loves Mary, written in the sand. I doubt any of you would stop and say, man, that's crazy. I've heard about earthquakes in California, but I had no idea when the ground shook, messages just rose to the top. None of you'd say, man, they got some crazy tides at the beaches in California that leave messages when they go back to low tide. None of you would say, well, the wind or erosion caused it. You'd know for sure that the only plausible explanation for that is some kind of intelligent agent. Either John does love Mary, or maybe Mary wants to be loved by John, or maybe someone's playing a trick on both of them. But the only possible cause for that is an intelligent mind that wrote it. You see, Stephen Meyer, he's a professor, he's a doctor. He said, whenever we find information and we know the causal story of how that information arose, we always find that it arose from an intelligent source. And he's right. Look, think about it. On your shirt says Broncos. That's information. You trace it back and you have a mind. If you get a book and there's information, you trace it back to what? To an author. You read a newspaper and you trace it back and you find a journalist. If you don't know what a newspaper is, ask your youth pastor. I'm just kidding. If you read a text and it's legible, traces back to a mind. If you go outside and in the clouds it says drink Coke, none of you would say, oh boy, that happens around here when a storm comes from the east. You would know that that arrangement of information would come from a pilot and an intelligent mind who wrote it. Friends, when we look inside the DNA in every cell in your body, we don't see the equivalent of drink Coke or John loves Mary. We see more sophisticated information than anything humans can come close to creating today. And I don't have enough faith to think that that could happen by accident. You know who else agrees with me? When I was in grad school 10 years ago, we read this well-known atheist by the name of Antony Flew. Antony Flew wrote a paper called Theology and Falsification that he presented before C.S. Lewis in Oxford in England in the 1950s about how the existence of God is meaningless. It was the most widely read philosophical treatise for 5 decades. Antony Flew said, there's no evidence for God. God cannot exist. Well, in 2007, Antony Flew wrote a book. You know what it was called? There Is a God. Why the world's most notorious atheist changed his mind. And you know one of the things that persuaded him? Look at what he said. He said, quote, what I think the DNA material has done is to show that intelligence must have been involved in getting these extraordinarily diverse elements together. The enormous complexity by which the results were achieved looks to me like the work of intelligence. Remember when I was an atheist, I said, the more we learn about science, the smaller the gaps come for God. What's the truth? It's the opposite. The more we learn about the tiny cell in your body, the origin of the universe, and the laws that govern our universe, the more we see the fingerprints of a creator. And we know that as David wrote 3,000 years ago, the skies proclaim the work of his hand. Day by day, they spew forth knowledge. Night by night, they display truth about God. Amen? Hey, let me stop for a minute, and then we're going to take a break, have some worship, have our last session. I want to know what questions you have. Questions from this session. Other questions related to science or evolution that you've heard. Maybe something I threw at you this morning that was not sufficiently answered. That you're sitting there going, because the last thing I want is you to leave today and wake up at midnight and go, oh, that was a good question. I have no answer. Ah, that would wreck my whole weekend. Okay, of course, you can always contact me on Facebook. We can all be friends today, right? I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. So I'm around. But, and of course, your youth pastor knows everything. Which is true of most youth pastors. Questions, thoughts about this or anything that's come up so far?
I teach business classes at the vocational college, and I know there are a number of seniors in this room. How many seniors are in this room?
Let me see your hands. How many seniors are here?
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4 seniors here. Going to be seniors.
How many? Yes, going to be seniors.
Okay, we got a few more if it's going to be seniors.
My concern is, you know, the world is just waiting. You know, it's like it's just waiting to, what little of Jesus is in you, the world just waiting just to suck that out of you. What can these seniors, or seniors-to-be, what can they do to help, you know, avoid?
To prepare that? Well, I would say a couple things. Number one is they have to start thinking and learning what they believe before they get pushed out of the nest, so to speak. So whether it's having a book club at your school, whether it's pushing your youth pastor, say, hey, let's do a series where we go deeper in how we know what we believe and why, whether it's getting some books and studying those. Before you leave, you have to know what you believe and why. The other thing is, again, the best example I know is Daniel. It wasn't just a head game for him. Daniel determined in his heart not to defile himself. So when Daniel was in the University of Babylon, in a different culture, in a very different environment, different language, different food, all this peer pressure, Daniel stood strong because he had determined before he got there where his identity was grounded, where his commitments lay. So when those challenges come, he stood strong. So know what you believe and why, on why, but also find your identity in Christ. If you do that now and start to really understand who you are in light of who God has made you to be, then when those temptations come, you're going to stand strong for it. You'll stand strong. Look, I was walking outside and someone dropped $20 near my book table. I'm not going to take that and steal it. Why? Because I'm not a thief. I don't steal things, except, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just going to make some up. I don't steal things. I don't. Doesn't mean when I'm younger in my life, I haven't done stupid things. Yeah, well, that's for sure. But because my identity, I don't see myself that way. And someone else saw it, someone else dropped it, and we make sure that he got it. But because I know who I am, and I don't want to steal stuff from other people and have my identity grounded, when that temptation comes, I'm not going to do it. Same with my wife, right? If some young, you know, person tries to hit on me or something, I'm not going to do that because I've made a commitment to my wife. Doesn't mean a temptation couldn't be there, but I've made a decision ahead of time that I'm going to be faithful to my wife. Well, young people have to make a decision ahead of time. I am a follower of Christ. I believe that this is true. And when those temptations come up, if you fall and you blow it, well, one of the great things about being Christian is we have grace. And we go back and we'll restore you when you step on. But I think if your identity is set ahead of time and you really believe it and you know why, you'll be in the best possible position to resist those challenges in that world that wants to just wring you dry and destroy you. Well, it says in 1 John 2:21 that we know that we have eternal life. I think this is knowledge that we can have. Now, knowledge doesn't necessarily mean certainty, but it means a confident, justified, true belief. And I think we can have that about the scriptures. Good question. Any questions from students about the scientific stuff that's come up? Yeah.
Have you heard about that new God particle that was supposed to be?
I have heard of the God particle. It's called the Higgs boson. It's been all over the news. They called it the God particle for two reasons. Number one, it seems to be an element that's so central to tying all the rest of physics together, kind of on the level that God plays in the universe. But it's also been incredibly hard to find. And they call it that because some would say, well, God seems hard to find. He seems distant. He'll seem absent. That's why they call it the God particle. Actually, the God particle, on CNN, when I was watching it, they said, this particle shows that we don't need God to explain the basic structure of the universe. On CNN, what a complete misunderstanding and a flat-out fabrication about what this particle does. All it is a particle from the standard model of physics, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., And they postulated that at certain temperatures and in a certain experiment, this particle would be there. They set up this billion-dollar experiment in Switzerland and Geneva, and it seems that they found the particle. It doesn't really prove or disprove God either way. It just further confirms our understanding of the physical world in itself. So those who say it's like disproving God are just reading into it or don't understand exactly what it is. That's what happens in the media all the time. You'll hear some new scientific find. They found the missing link. They found the body of Jesus, the gospel of Judas. When I was your age, this stuff used to freak me out. Oh my gosh. And then the older I get and the more confidence I have, I realize, boy, the Bible's true and it's going to withstand the challenges. God created the world, and I have nothing to fear by these challenges if the science is done well. Any others related to this or something else I role played as an atheist? All the way in the back.
What about
the fossil record, very quickly. There is a book coming out this month by the person I quoted, Stephen Meyer. It's called Darwin's Doubt. I have ordered it, but I have not gotten it yet. I've been listening to some podcasts about it. He is a PhD trained from Cambridge University, one of the oldest, most prestigious universities in the world. And he said, the reason he called it Darwin's Doubt is during Darwin's day, he thought his theory was true, but he had significant doubt for one primary reason. It was a part of the fossil record called the Cambrian explosion. In other words, Darwin's theory would say that you'd first have life, and then life would show up intermittently and spread out over time in this tree. But Darwin realized during his day that in this period called the Cambrian, there was simple life forms, simple, 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 and then in a geological instant, all the major phyla body plans are just like placed there in the fossil record without any precursors. So Darwin said, this is by far the gravest objection that could be raised against my theory. But he thought, as we discovered more about the fossil record, it would confirm his theory. 154 years later, I can tell you, we have discovered more about the fossil record, and it is more at odds with Darwin's theory than when he first discovered it. Now, you don't always read about this, you don't hear about it, because those in power in the university and in the media are very friendly with Darwin. But if you want to read and get the other side and study from trained people, not just some, you know, some guy on the internet who knows how to make a web page, there are serious, grave challenges to Darwin's theory in what's called the Cambrian explosion. Because these major life forms, bam, are just placed there. And it kind of sounds to me like Genesis, when things were made according to their kinds. Interesting. That'd be my take on it. So, good question. I saw one or two more hands. Yeah.
In the morning role play, you hit at the very end about the importance of like loving, in a loving way, defending our faith. And so right now with the things that you're talking about, could you give like a little example of how you would engage yourself in the jacket with some of these questions regarding like the scientific findings and stuff?
So you want me to put the jacket on, be the atheist, take it off and respond? This is going to get awkward. You know, I guess what I would have done. I would have probably said, hey, thanks for coming. It's good to have you here. You're obviously thoughtful about these things, and there's 150 of us and one of you, so I'm sure you feel like everybody's piling on you. But here's a question. As I've read books in favor of atheism and against it, there's a question that I don't feel has been sufficiently answered, and I wonder if you can help me with it. It's related to the origin of life, but in particular, the origin of information. Given that we know within the cell there's the equivalent of 8,000 books, and Richard Dawkins, as you know, is one of the leading atheists in the world, says the equivalent of 8,000 books. Now, in his book, The God Delusion, he says luck explains it. Do you really believe luck can account for the origin of information? If you disagree with Dawkins, what would be a better explanation for it? Now, you don't have to do it quite that wordy and quote all the people, but the idea is, my dad always taught me, keep the main thing the main thing. What are the biggest problems for atheism? Well, one is how you get information from a purely blind process. So tell me. And then I would have made something up. And if I didn't answer it, I would have just said, okay, that's really interesting what you said. And some of that may be true, but I want to know, what is your mechanism that explains information through a blind, purposeless process? So my man up here was like, tell me the story from the first Adam to humans today. And I could be like, well, that's too big. I mean, no one can answer that in 30 seconds. But I said, I want to know the information in the cell. What is your mechanism to explain that? I thought the question about morality was good. I thought the question about the origin of the universe was fine. But that's one I would hit on. I probably would have asked him what he thought about Jesus. I mean, nobody asked me about that. Interestingly enough, because this is a Christian conference. I mean, you would have thought maybe that would have come up about Jesus. So if you're looking for like a gold, you know, a silver bullet that you ask and they go, I give up, man, there's nothing. In my jacket, I never would have conceded that. I would have made something up, quoted some author, flipped it back on you. Right? I mean, that's because it's a heart issue. But I would get the main thing. How do you get a universe from nothing? Why is the universe fine-tuned? Where does real right and wrong come from? Where does information come from? And not just conscience, consciousness. How does matter in motion become this thinking, reasoning self? What atheistic process would explain that? Those get right to the heart of the matter. So those are some things that I probably would have asked. I might have also asked him his favorite superhero, because that's always very insightful into somebody's intellect. I'm just kidding. Partly. All right, one last question, then we'll take a break. I know it's afternoon, day after summer. You guys are rock stars for being here. All right, tell you, okay, last one. Shed some light on the geological column and how they use it to prove evolution. Like dating wise, look, I don't know where your church stands on this, but I'll tell you this. I don't think the central issue, if you're talking to an atheist that you want to go to, is the age of the earth. I don't think that's where your battleground should be. There are Bible-believing, committed Christians who believe the earth is young. There are Bible-believing, committed Christians who believe the earth is old on both sides of the issues. And the old earthers who embrace that are not slackers who are compromisers and liberalizers who want to wreck the church. And the young earthers who believe that are not backwood fundamentalists who just want to force their views on everybody else. We all have to make sense of the science. We have to make sense of what the scriptures teach. So in keeping the main thing, some of you brought up issues like how can you prove carbon dating? I'm just telling you, any atheist, whether right or wrong, if you try to argue a young earth, they're going to write you off so fast, they're not even going to listen to what you have to say. Now, the earth might be young, it might be old. I'm just saying, if you're going to reason with somebody, put forward your most powerful argument and leave out your weakest one. So if you can establish God exists, there's a mind behind the universe, atheism is false, the Bible's true, then like politics can come later. Some of those in-house discussions among Christians, I think, can come later as well. Because once we see the Bible as a source of authority, then it might interpret something that I find difficult. But if it's an authority to me, then I'm okay with it. So that's the route that I would go. Does God exist? Is Jesus God? Has he revealed himself in the scriptures? And if so, how he's revealed himself in the scriptures, then what the scriptures say are true. Okay? So that's my two cents on that question. Let's take a break. 3:05. We're gonna start at 3:20. Okay? We're gonna start at 3:20. So we have a 15-minute break, and then we're gonna have some worship. Then we're gonna do our last session. Oh, I need to give some books away. Are you ready? Free books.